This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jenna Fischer, is best known for her role on the NBC series The Office. She plays Pam, the receptionist, one of the most real characters in this comedy series. I think if you've ever worked in a clerical position in an alienating office, you can relate to what she goes through. Fischer also co-starred in the film comedies Blades of Glory and Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. Her new film, The Promotion, opens in select cities this Friday. Fischer plays a nurse in Chicago, married to a supermarket assistant manager. He's competing for a promotion to store manager at the chain's new property. Sean William Scott plays the husband. John C. Reilly plays his chief competitor for the new job. Here's a scene from the film featuring Fischer and Scott. Their characters live in a small apartment and are hoping to find a house they can afford. In this scene, they're on their bed with the newspaper looking through the real estate ads.
We should go get that house this week, because I'm going to get that job, and I feel really good about things.
Me too. Maybe we should wait, though.
I'm a shoe-in, and someone's going to snag that house. Let's do it.
Shoe-in?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do it.
Jenna Fischer, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you get the part in The Promotion?
I had to audition for The Promotion. I had been cast in The Office, and The Office had been on the air, but I hadn't had any films come out yet. So I read this script, and I went in to meet with the director to do an audition. And, you know, my role in this movie, I play a nurse in the city of Chicago, and I live in a studio apartment with my husband, and he's trying to get a promotion at his new job so that we can have a better life, and we really live paycheck to paycheck. So I went into this audition trying to, you know, look like a struggling nurse from Chicago. And after the audition, they told me that they really loved my performance. I was their top choice, but the big studio producers of this movie weren't 100% sure that I had the charisma of a movie star. It hadn't been proven yet. So they asked me to come back in and do the same performance, but to look really, really hot, like a movie star would. And which I thought was crazy, because I thought, well, I'm a struggling Chicago nurse. I wouldn't look like that. But luckily, the day of my callback, I was shooting the sexy lingerie scene in Blades of Glory, and I asked the hair and makeup artists to help me out, and I had on tan body makeup and fake eyelashes, and I wore this low-cut blouse, and I went into this audition and did the same performance, but looking, well, I felt like a prostitute. I mean, I looked ridiculous. And they told me that the studio heads watched it on their private jet and approved.
They like the prostitute
thing. They were jetting. Yeah, I really did. I felt, it felt so wrong, you know. It was such an example of how it's, unfortunately, you know, it's not just your performance, you know. They have to believe your movie star. And then, of course, when they made the movie, I don't look like that in the movie. I look like a real Chicago nurse who's struggling from paycheck to paycheck.
But the funny thing is, by the time the movie did come out, you were a star because of The Office.
Yes, by the time the movie came out, The Office was very popular, and Blades of Glory came out, and you know, the Judd Apatow movie Walk Hard had come out. So by the time this film eventually hit the screens, you know, I had this resume that I didn't have when I walked in the door for the audition.
So how is The Office affecting your movie career?
It's opened a lot of doors. I mean, I think that the thing that was happening to me when I was out here and I was struggling and trying to make it, I would get very far. And it was sort of similar to the story of getting the job for The Promotion. It was, you know, I'd go in and I'd do my best, but I'd be in a room full of famous faces, and they would cast a famous face because they needed someone for the poster. So The Office has given me a famous face, so now I can compete with some of those other actresses.
Well, how'd you get the role on The Office? And I think just about everyone in The Office, maybe not Rainn Wilson, certainly not Steve Carell, but you know, most of the people in The Office were unknown when they were cast and have since, you know, become very well known. So I guess that wasn't a big problem, being an unknown. But what did you have to do in the audition?
My very first audition for The Office, I had to sit in a chair, and the producer interviewed me in character. There was no script. He just said, we want you to act like Pam or your idea of Pam, and we're going to interview you like a documentary film crew might. And they asked me a lot of questions about, did I like working at a paper company? How long had I lived in Scranton? How did I feel about being filmed by a documentary crew? And my take on the character of Pam was that she didn't have any media training, so she didn't know how to be a good interview. And also, she didn't care about this interview. And so I gave very short, one-word answers. And I tried very hard not to be funny or clever, because I thought that the comedy would come out of just, you know, the real human reactions to the situation. And it was great. It was great. We clicked quickly, and they liked that take on it.
So in your one-word answers, like, what did you say to the questions you were asked in the audition?
Well, it's funny. The casting director, before I went in, I had known her for a few years, and she had called me in for other jobs. And she gave me some coaching on the phone. What she said was, don't come in looking pretty, which, you know, is completely different from my audition for the promotion that, you know, they said, we need you to look as hot as possible. She said to me, you know, Jenna, I'm always telling you, you know, look really hot. A lot of times when you go in on an audition, they want you to look inappropriately sexy or hot for the role. And I used to get called in to play things like, oh, like a third grade school teacher, but look really hot. And so in this instance, when I went in for the office, the casting director said to me, she said, please look normal. Don't make yourself all pretty, and dare to bore me with your audition. Those were her words, dare to bore me. She said, please do not come in and do a bunch of shtick and try to be funny and clever, because it's not that kind of show. So when I went into the audition, the first question that they asked me in the character of Pam, they said, do you like working as a receptionist? And I said, no. And that was it. I didn't speak any more than that. And they started laughing, and then they asked me a few more questions. My answers were really nothing. They were just yes and no answers. And I felt like the comedy would come in watching me think about what I wasn't going to say instead of
right.
in what I said.
And that's classic The Office, because, you know, one of the premises of The Office is that there's somewhere between a reality TV show and a documentary being shot in the office. So the characters are always either directly talking to the camera or glancing sideways at the camera while the action's going on, and often giving very pained looks because their boss Michael is behaving so badly. And you have classic pained looks that you give the camera.
Well, my character of Pam is really stuck. I mean, she's a subordinate in this office. And so I think that for her, the only way she can express herself is in the silences. But you can say so much by not saying anything.
So when you're giving one of your pained looks or one of your this is absurd looks to the camera, who's the camera person? Is there an actor behind there that you can kind of like interact with, or is it just like the camera with a camera person?
Well, there's two different scenarios. When we're just shooting the show and it's a scene, the camera operator is this man named Randall Einhorn, and he's our director of photography. And we will look at him, we'll give him the look, or we'll look into the camera at him. And he's become another character or another actor on the show to us. So we do actually act with him, and it's really cute. Whenever Pam smiles at the camera, Randall can't help but smile back. The man, Randall, smiles at you while he's holding the camera. And there are scenes that we've done that have been really touching, and you'll look at Randall and he'll be, you know, sort of teared up. And when we shoot our talking heads, our interview segments, the director of the episode serves as our documentarian for that week. some of the directors, we have them back again and again and again. And one director we're particularly attached to is Ken Kwapis. He directed our very first episode, and he comes back every year and directs a couple of episodes. And last year he directed the finale. And he's always taken a particular interest in Pam and her journey. So I feel very close to him. And in that moment when Jim burst into the conference room while Pam's giving an interview and he finally asks her out on a date, I turn to the camera, and in the moment that they used, I'm sort of tearing up. And the reason that I teared up was because when I looked back at the camera, I saw Ken Kwapis, and his eyes were full of tears. And he smiled at me and gave me a little wink, like, that's right, you finally got what you wanted, sweetie. And it just, it was a really powerful moment between me and the director. So it's interesting, there's a lot of acting that happens on the show that is with our crew members or, you know, people that doesn't normally happen when you're making a movie or a television show.
That's really nice. So it sounds like you're very emotionally involved in your character Pam's life.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so attached to her journey. I really love playing this character so much.
Now, how were you cast opposite John Krasinski? Did you have to do a scene together before you were both cast to make sure that there was chemistry between you? And for anyone who doesn't watch The Office, I should mention that he's one of the people who works in the office, and you had a long period of flirtation, but, you know, when The Office starts, you're engaged to somebody else, and even though things aren't working out between you two, you still feel like, you know, you're involved in this relationship and you can't get involved with the John Krasinski character of Jim. But eventually, you do get together. So there has to be this chemistry between you. So were you tested out together during the audition?
Yes. When it came down to the end of the audition process, they took 4 Pams and 4 Jims and 4 Dwights and 4 Michaels, and they brought us into a real office, and they filmed us with a camera for 2 days, mixing and matching us. And over the course of that 2 days, I was mixed and matched with John several times. And after the second day, we were walking out of a scene, and he turned to me and he said, "You're my favorite Pam. I hope you get this job." And I smiled really big and I said, "I'm so glad you said that because you're my favorite Jim. And I don't think anyone could do it except for you." And when they called and told me that I got the job, I said, "Please tell me that John Krasinski is playing Jim." And they said, "He is. And we're so glad to hear you say that because we thought you two had amazing chemistry. And we're glad you think so, too."
Are you friends off the set?
We are, yeah. It is the strangest thing to have a long-term fictional love interest. It's a type of relationship that is very intimate and it's very powerful, but it's fictional. I mean, there is a part of me that is Pam, and there's a part of him that is Jim, and that part of me is in love with that part of him. But in real life, we are just friends.
My guest is Jenna Fischer. She plays Pam, the receptionist, on the NBC series The Office. Her new movie, The Promotion, opens in select cities Friday. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenna Fischer, and she plays Pam on The Office. Her movies include Blades of Glory and Walk Hard, and she co-stars in the new film, The Promotion. One of the things that happens on The Office often is that you or Jim instigate a joke, and sometimes it's an in-joke just between the two of you. Sometimes it's a larger joke within the whole office. And I want to play one of those classic moments where you instigate the joke. And this is a scene from an episode in which Michael, the Steve Carell character, the boss in the office, your supervisor, he's lost somebody who was a former colleague. The former colleague has died, so he decides to, he decides to gather everybody from the office in a circle and have everybody talk about somebody that they've lost and what it meant to them. And it's an incredibly inappropriate thing to do in the office, of course. And he has like a ball, a grief ball, and he tosses it to the person who he wants to speak next.
Okay, why don't you throw the ball to somebody else?
Nope.
Oh, yes, Stanley, come on. Your turn. You have to go.
I will not.
Okay. I'm going to toss the ball to Pam.
Let's see. I had an aunt that I was really close to. She was this amazing female boxer. Anyway, she was injured in a fight, and she was paralyzed. So you can imagine how upset I was when I found out that she asked her manager to remove her breathing tube so she could die.
Wow. If you want to cry, that's okay.
That's a scene from The Office. My guest is Jenna Fischer, who plays Pam. Do you have a favorite example of one of the times when Michael, the Steve Carell character, came up to your desk and did really bad shtick?
Oh, gosh. Well, my favorite Pam-Michael moment from the entire series happens in season one, actually. He comes up to my desk and he wads up a piece of paper and he goes to throw it into the trash can behind me, but instead it hits me in the head. And Pam looks at Michael and she says, "Please don't throw garbage at me." And I loved that moment because I thought, here's a girl who actually has to say to her boss, "Please don't throw garbage at me." It's like such a known thing, you know? It's just like such a thing that any normal person would know not to do. But I felt like that summed up their entire relationship, that Pam is constantly having to educate Michael on simple human interaction.
Are there any scenes from The Office that were too funny to get through without laughing and you had to keep reshooting them?
Oh, so many. So many. You know what happens is I seem to, every year, get tickled by a new actor in a way where I cannot do a scene with them. And the first year was Rainn Wilson. You know, Pam and Dwight did not have a lot of interaction, so any time we did have a scene one-on-one, I just couldn't get through it. Rainn Wilson, he has this weird way that he stands where he pushes his pelvis and his gut sort of out.
Yeah.
And he breathes through his mouth. And so just to have him approach me is funny. And there was a scene where Ed Helms's character of Andy plays the banjo for Pam. He's trying to woo her. And so he plays her Rainbow Connection on the banjo, but he sings it in Pig Latin. And I could not get through that. We shot that at 6:30 in the morning. And there's not a whole lot that's hilarious to me at 6:30 in the morning, since I'm not a morning person, but that got me. That one, I could not stop laughing.
So are there experiences that you've drawn on and have passed on to the writers of The Office that they've actually used in the series?
Well, gosh, I remember early on they would ask me a lot of things about my time in an office. And, you know, Angela Kinsey, who plays the accountant, the little prissy accountant on the show, she worked at 1-800-DENTIST for a long time. And mm-hmm. she and I would go in the writer's room and they would ask us questions about what it was like to work in a phone bank or in an office. And I can't think of a specific story, but one time, Angela and I were talking over lunch, and she and I came up with the idea of having a Women in the Workplace seminar. And so we went to the writers and we said, "We have an idea for a show. We think that Jan should come in and have a Women in the Workplace seminar, and Michael will get jealous and have his own Men in the Workplace seminar. And they'll have these, like, competing workshops." And the writer said, "Oh, we love that. That's great. So then what happens?" And we said, "I don't know. That's all we got." And they did actually end up writing that episode.
Here's a scene from the episode she was just describing, Women in the Workplace. It starts with Jan, a supervisor from corporate headquarters.
"So, I'm happy to be here. It's very nice to see all of you. You're all looking well.
Today's a Women in the Workplace thing. Jan's coming in from corporate to talk to all the women about, I don't really know what, but Michael's not allowed in. She said that about 5 times.
Women today, though we have the same options as men, we often face a very different set of obstacles in getting there. So..."
"Hey, what's going on?"
"Michael,
Yeah, I thought about it. I just have a few things I want to say.
What are you doing?
Just hear me out. What is more important than quality? Equality. Now, studies show that today's woman, the Allie McBeal woman, as I call her, is at a crossroads.
Michael.
And you have come a long way, baby. But I just want to keep it within reason. They did this up in
you
Albany.
You are not allowed in.
And they ended up turning the break
session.
Room into a lactation room, which is disgusting.
Now you're really not allowed in this session.
Well, I'm their boss. So
I'm
I
your
feel
boss.
Like anybody want any coffee or anything?
We're fine, Michael. We just need you to leave, please.
A scene from The Office. Jenna Fischer will be back in the second half of the show. Her new movie, The Promotion, opens in select cities this Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jenna Fischer. In the NBC comedy series The Office, she plays Pam, the receptionist. She co-starred in the film comedies Blades of Glory and Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Her new movie, The Promotion, opens in select cities this Friday. Would you tell the story of the time you were auditioning for a singing group that was supposed to be like the Spice Girls?
Yes. Well, when I came to LA, I was really willing to just hustle and do whatever I had to. And, I'll tell that story, but there's another story that is an untold story. My very first acting job that I got after I moved to Los Angeles, I answered an ad in the back of a newspaper, and it was, I got paid $100, and I was in a sex education video for mental patients upon their release from UCLA Medical Center.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm sure that tape exists somewhere, but I played a girl who was going on a date, and my older sister came in the bathroom, and she asked me, did I like this boy? And I said, oh, yes, I really like him. And she said, well, are you bringing protection? And I said, protection? Protection from what? And she said, well, if you decide to become sexually active, you need protection from pregnancy and STDs. And she opens up our bathroom drawer. And in our bathroom drawer is every contraceptive imaginable, including an IUD, which is like has to be implanted by your gynecologist. It's hilarious. And she holds them each up one by one and describes the pros and cons and how they work and if they protect against STDs or just against pregnancy. And I sit and I listen very earnestly, and then I say, thanks, sis, and I go off to my date. That was my very first acting job.
That is so great. Did you have to audition for it?
I did. I had to audition. I guess, again, most of that job was listening, so I have some career in being a good listener or something.
So tell the singing group story.
Yes. Well, a friend of mine found a listing in the back of the newspaper that said there were auditions, open call auditions, to try to find the fifth member of an all-girl singing group that was being billed as the International Spice Girls, because the Spice Girls were very big at the time. And my friend was a singer, and she asked me if I would come to the audition with her. And I said, oh, absolutely. And just for fun, I decided to sing as well. I thought, well, I'll audition while I'm there. And I'm not even kidding you, I'm a terrible singer. As proven by when I did the movie Walk Hard, they dubbed my voice with a professional singer because I couldn't cut it. But for whatever reason, I got the job in the International Spice Girls. I sang These Boots Are Made for Walkin' at my audition, the Nancy Sinatra song, because it only has like three notes in it and they're all in the mid-C range, which is about all my voice can handle. And I got a call the next day that I had gotten the part. The producer was very excited. He said he thought I was very wholesome looking, and they were going to sell me as a sweet country girl in this. I was going to be, very Americana as part of this International Spice Girls, and we were going to sing on tour, and, was I ready? And he invited me to his apartment for a rehearsal, which is, when you've been out in the business and you meet legitimate producers, you realize that they don't hold auditions or have meetings in their apartments. But I didn't know that. I was fresh off the bus. Basically, when I got to the producer's apartment, I noticed that there were other girls there, but they were all walking around in lingerie, as if they lived there. And he would sort of point upstairs and he'd be like, oh, there's, you know, Svetlana. You know, she's our Russian girl. And I would sort of wave to Svetlana. What I didn't know about the International Spice Girls was that this was a cover for a call girl operation, a high-priced call girl operation. But I was so naive that it took me about 2 weeks to figure it out. My first clue should have been when the producer manager of the group offered to take nude photographs of me. but it did not clue me in. What he said to me was, you know, in addition to the singing group, we will manage your acting career. And what if you had to go on an audition where there was nudity required? What would you do? You wouldn't want to have to get naked in the casting director's office. Instead, you can just show them this new nude photograph that we've taken of you. And I was smart enough to know that no one asks you to get nude in the casting director's office, that that's not legitimate. But I just said to him, I wouldn't want any roles where I have to be nude anyway. So I wouldn't be going on those types of auditions, so I don't think we need nude photographs of me. So now I'm starting to get suspicious. I'm thinking there's something here that's not right. And then my second clue was that every time I went to a quote-unquote rehearsal, the other girls in the group were just sort of lounging around in lingerie in this penthouse apartment. And no one was doing any singing or dancing except me. I was the only one practicing a song. And finally, the producer said to me, okay, you have your first show. He called it a show, and he said it's on Friday, and it's going to be for a group of traveling Japanese businessmen, which is so cliche, so cliche, but the true. And he said, and, you know, after the show, it would be very nice if you provided these gentlemen with some companionship, and you only have to do as much as you want to do. But some of the girls have found that this is a really wonderful way to make some extra income. And that was when I finally realized.
So what did you say to him?
That this was not a singing group. I actually became sort of frightened because I was in his apartment when he told me this. And so I nodded and I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. That sounds really good. And then I went home and I changed my contact information. You know, I changed my phone numbers, actually, and I just sort of dropped off the face of the planet so that he couldn't reach me or find me again, because he did not know where I lived. He only had like a beeper number that was in the time of beepers. He had my beeper number, so I got a new beeper. And I had a boyfriend at the time who was furious and very protective.
My guest is Jenna Fischer. She plays Pam, the receptionist, on the NBC series The Office. Her new movie, The Promotion, opens in select cities Friday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Jenna Fischer. On the NBC series The Office, she plays Pam, the receptionist. She co-stars in the new film, The Promotion. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri.
How did you get to L.A.?
I drove here in a little beat-up Mazda 323 hatchback with my futon mattress strapped to the top and my my cat is now 16 years old, but he was 5 at the time, and he was in a little cat carrier in the back seat, and we drove here together for 3 days. And that's how I got to L.A. I knew ever since I was a little girl that I wanted to be an actress. And when I was a girl, I was very disappointed that my mother wasn't a stage mother. It really frustrated me. I was part of a dance troupe or part of theater companies, and it was very clear that the mothers who came around a lot and sewed costumes and badgered the directors, that those girls would get lead roles. And my mom would not do that. And I used to think, oh, she doesn't support this for me. But now that I'm an adult, I realize how very wise she is. And they always encouraged me to be an actress. They always said it was fine. They let me sign up for whatever I wanted to sign up for. But she told me that being a professional actress was something that I could do when it was time for me to be an adult and get an adult job, that would be my career, and that my childhood was my childhood, and it was important for me to have that as well. And of course, as a kid, you don't want to hear that. I always thought that time was ticking and, you know, I'm never going to make it. And when I graduated from high school, I wanted to move to Los Angeles immediately, and I graduated early. I was 17. I wanted to move to L.A. at 17, and my parents said no. They said, you can move to Los Angeles after college, and They said, you can go to college, you can major in theater if you want, but you have to go to college and complete college. It's a very important time, they felt, in going from child to adulthood, and a really great way to sort of baby step into the responsibilities of being an adult. And of course, they're right. They were right. And I thank them so much for that because, you know, had I moved here at 17, I probably would have become a member of the International Spice Girls. And I would have been too naive to take care of myself because even, you know, listen, even at 23, I was challenged. So, I'm grateful to them now, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any contacts. I had a few people from college who were living out here and I moved in with them.
So although you impressed the producer of The Prostitution Ring with your singing, when you were in Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, you were dubbed. And Dewey Cox is a movie biography of a fictional singer named Dewey Cox, and it's a parody of films like Walk the Line and Ray. And you play his second wife, a kind of June Carter Cash character. And
yes.
And you sing duets with your husband, who's played by John C. Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
So let me play a clip of your first meeting, you and Dewey Cox. And here it is.
Mr. Cox, I heard you were looking for a new backup singer for your new duet.
You heard right.
I was wondering if you might like to give me a try.
I reckon I might.
I've been singing in my church choir since I was a girl.
I like the sound of that.
Darlene Madison.
Dewey Cox.
Hello, Darlene.
Hello, Mr. Cox.
You ready to sing one?
I'm always ready.
Well, all right. In my dreams, you're blowing me some kisses.
That's one of my favorite things to do.
You and I could go down in history.
That's what I'm praying to do. With you.
Let's duet in ways that make us feel good. Let's duet.
It was Jenna Fischer and John C. Reilly in a scene from Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Now, the song that we just heard an excerpt of is so funny. It's just like one double entendre after another. Was it hard to just keep a straight face while shooting that?
It really was. That whole movie was fun in that way. I love satirical comedy. One of my favorite movies growing up was Airplane. And I love that, you know, very straight-faced, very earnest, honest readings of these ridiculous lines and in being in these weird situations, but playing it totally, totally straight.
And you're so good at it.
It makes me laugh. That's my sense of humor. So I guess I feel pretty lucky that I've gotten to work on projects that are things I would want to see.
Now, I think it was about 3 days after you filmed Walk Hard that you fell down a flight of marble stairs and fractured 4 vertebrae. Do I have that right?
That's right, yeah.
That sounds
4 transverse vertebrae in my back.
Oh, how much pain was that?
You know, I was walking down the set of stairs and I just lost my footing. And as I was falling, I just knew that I was falling farther and longer than was going to be safe. I could just feel it in that moment. And when I hit the stairs, I had this pain that I'd never experienced before. I've never broken a bone before. But the pain was so overwhelming and instantaneous that it made me dizzy and nauseous. And my friend Angela Kinsey from the show found me and one of the producers from the show because we were at a work event and they said, you know, we think you need to go to the hospital. They lifted up my shirt and I had, in addition to breaking bones, I had cut myself. The impact of the fall had left, you know, had cut my skin and I was bleeding. And so they called an ambulance and they took me to the hospital. And I really thought while I was going to the hospital, I really thought that the doctor was going to x-ray me and all this sort of stuff, and he was going to come back and say, well, miss, you have got a nasty bruise, and you're going to be in some pain. You know, it's maybe like the equivalent of a car accident, some whiplash or something. But he came back, and he said, well, I have some good news and bad news. He said, the good news is you will walk again.
Oh, there's God.
You have no spinal cord damage. And I thought, wow, if they're starting with that's the good news, now I'm scared. I was terrified. And I was holding Angela's hand, and he said, you have fractured 4 of the transverse vertebrae in your back. And I didn't know what that meant. And I just looked at Angela, and we shared this moment. And it was like the most pure sort of moment of like fear that I've ever shared with another person. And I don't remember what the doctor said after that. And eventually a specialist came in and explained that my injury was actually, as far as back injuries go, it's the only one that has absolutely no lasting damage. And he said, you'll be walking the next 3 days. You know, you're going to be stiff, but you need to walk every day. And it's very similar to breaking your ribs there. It's very painful, but there's nothing you can do. Except wait for the bone to heal, and that takes, you know, up to 4 months for bone to be completely healed. So, but you also have to be mobile. So I would have to walk every day, and I was stuck in New York City for 3.5 weeks recuperating.
Wow. I'm glad that you had a full recovery from that. You're in a studio in L.A. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia. I have no idea how you're dressed or what you look like. On a scale of the babe that they used to want you to dress like at auditions and Pam when she was just wearing like baggy shirts and cardigans, how do you dress when you're out as yourself?
Oh, well, I would sort of describe my style as mother of three without the children. So very, very comfort based, low effort, dressing. Although today, since I wanted to appear somewhat professional, I did put on a pair of jeans and a nice blazer and some high heels, but this is a special occasion. Usually you'll find me in some version of sweatpants and a hoodie.
Thanks for dressing up for our invisible medium of radio.
You're welcome.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Jenna Fischer plays Pam, the receptionist on The Office. Her new film, The Promotion, opens in select cities Friday. One of the institutions that my city, Philadelphia, is proudest of is the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Yeah, it's the museum whose steps were made famous by Rocky, but it's the art inside that makes it great. And the person most responsible for transforming the museum into a great museum was Anne Darnancourt. She died Sunday at the age of 64. She'd come home after minor surgery and then suffered cardiac arrest. Her death has shocked Philadelphia and the art world. Darnancourt became the Philadelphia Museum of Art's curator of 20th century art in 1972. 10 years later, she became the first woman to head a major American museum when she was named director of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. One of her areas of specialization was the work of Marcel Duchamp. The museum has the most complete collection of his work. I spoke with Darnancourt about Duchamp in 1987, when the museum celebrated the centennial of his birth. Marcel Duchamp first shocked the art world in 1913 when he displayed his painting Nude Descending a Staircase at the Armory Show in New York. That show introduced European modern art to America. He continued to shock the art world with his sculptures and with his found objects, which he called ready-mades. His art and his ideas made him perhaps the most influential avant-garde artist of the 20th century. Do you think it's fair to say that Marcel Duchamp's greatest contributions weren't necessarily his art objects, but his ideas about art?
I do think that's probably fair to say, although any time you make a firm statement like that about Duchamp, usually you have to turn around and make the reverse, because in a sense, his art objects, to an extraordinary degree, and more than almost any other artist I can think of, embody his ideas. He was terrifically interested in the whole problem, as he put it, of putting art once again at the service of the mind.
After a few years as a painter, he gave up painting. Why did he do that?
Every time he reached something that satisfied him, like the new descending the staircase, he would turn around and try to do something altogether different. He said he always said that he tried to contradict himself as much as possible in order to avoid conforming to his own taste. And so when he'd finished with the new descending the staircase, he made a few more studies in paint, but they were studies directed towards this amazing project, which took him over 10 years to do, called The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelor's Even, a wonderful and mysterious title. And it's all played out on two large panes of glass in the Philadelphia Museum of Art and also in a bunch of notes that Duchamp wrote to himself.
Well, he says something about the large glass that you quote in the museum show, and this is a running theme in his work. The glass must not be looked at in the aesthetic sense of the word.
That's right. I think he was very much for divorcing. He was against art with a capital A. He was all for artists. He was all for people who made art one way and another. But it bothered him that people put art on some kind of pedestal, and therefore I think because then he thought that they didn't think about it. And for him, art was very much a practice of the mind. It's why I think one of the reasons he was so interested in chess. Which he saw in some ways as an alternative to making art, because chess he thought of as a beautifully intellectual but sculptural game. In other words, you play the game out in your mind, and you always think of it in physical terms, in terms of where the pieces move and what the pieces are. And he was really trying to get people to do that with works of art.
Duchamp gave up painting. And then he said he'd given up art altogether after the large glass. This was about 1923. He made a statement that he'd given up art. What were the public reasons that he gave for that?
You know, I'm not absolutely sure that he ever said that he'd given up art. I'm not sure it wasn't what everybody else said about him. He was always very polite. He was always given to be happy to be interviewed and to talk about what he was doing or what he was not doing. And very late in his life, for example, he said, "Of course, I've never been anything but an artist."
Most people assume that Duchamp had given up making art. But after his death, it was discovered that he'd spent the last 20 years of his life working on a major piece, a piece which is now on exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art called the Étain Donnée. Why do you think that he contradicted himself in saying that he wasn't really making art when, in fact, he was working on this really major piece for over 20 years?
Well, I don't know that we're ever going to quite know the answer to that, because he was so quiet, so secret about this piece that he never talked about it to anybody, so we have no glimmer. I think looking at the piece, which in fact you have to do through two little holes in an old wooden door, and you see this amazingly realistic scene of a nude woman holding up a little gas lamp, and she's lying on a bed of twigs with a rather peaceful landscape in the background and a little waterfall sparkling in the distance. If you look at that as a work of art and you realize how odd it is in Duchamp's, not so much in his career, because if you think about it, it makes lots of connections with other works, but to do this very intensely realistic thing, particularly that has some real erotic content, I don't think he would have had a moment's peace if everybody knew he'd been working on it.
You have access to Marcel Duchamp's greatest pieces of work. How often do you like to go look at them? He never thought of his art as aesthetic in that sense. Do you prefer to actually go and be with the work, look at the work, or is it sufficient for you to think about it?
Actually, that's one of the nice ironies about Duchamp's work. I find that I go back again and again, and every time I go, I see something new. So it's not that Duchamp himself denied the pleasures of vision or of the optical. He was certainly interested in them, but that he gives you something to think about while you're looking.
Has he changed your views of art?
I'm sure he has. It's hard for me to think of how I thought about art before I thought about Duchamp, because I thought about Duchamp just by that wonderful chance of coming to Philadelphia first some 20 years ago and getting all tangled up in his work just as I was thinking about early modern art in general. And in fact, a lot of my experience of contemporary art, of the art of our own time, has come since then. So I really am incapable of saying what I would, how I would look at art if it weren't for Duchamp, because he's simply somebody that I paid a lot of attention to early on.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Darnancourt, recorded in 1987 when the Philadelphia Museum of Art was celebrating the centennial of Marcel Duchamp's birth. Darnancourt was a longtime director of the museum. She died Sunday at the age of 64. She will be greatly missed in our city and the art world. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Menhivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.